Somebody did ask if I could give the talk on the middle way, and I never really managed to fit that into the talk. So I want to talk about the middle way this evening here, because it's an important part of the spiritual practice. It's an important part of our life, because sometimes when people get involved in religion, sometimes people can be very ascetic, you know, to the point of huge austerity. Or sometimes we can be indulgent, and sometimes you see some religious leaders living in palaces and big penthouses. And, you know, we wonder in our own spiritual life, you know, how much should we really get into that world, and how much should we be ascetic? Should we always give up things, or what should we do? And it's an important question, because it does affect your life, but it's not just a spiritual life. I don't really think you can... You can make a huge separation between, you know, what you do when you work in your home and the spiritual part of your life. They all really should come together, and eventually they do come together. And one of the great teachings of Buddhism was this thing called the middle path. And what it was actually doing was pointing out that it's just so easy to just wander off on a path of just too much harshness to your body and to your mind, the path of asceticism. You know, sometimes too much indulgence as well. But there is that beautiful thing in the middle called the middle path. And I know certainly in my life as a monk, I've been a monk for 36 years now, and the first 9 years of those 36 were spent in Thailand, and the first years of that were very ascetic. And sometimes I tell the monks, oh, in the good old days, we didn't have breakfast, we didn't have all this nice food, we didn't have beds to sleep on. And I love telling the stories of the good old days, because Thailand in those days, it was really, really ascetic for Westerners. Not only are you sleeping on the floor, but even the floor wasn't even. These were logs which were cut by the villagers, and they had big holes, you know, between them. They didn't sort of tongue and groove like you get from Bunnings. This is like big gaps in there. And that's where all the tarantulas and the scorpions came up. And I'm not joking, there were all these things. Sometimes during the hot weather, you know, you'd be laying there and the tarantulas would actually fall from the roof, you know, on top of your body and go as they would crawl over your chest. And actually, they didn't really mind the tarantulas, they were just tickly, that's all. You should actually, it's quite pleasant, a tarantula crawling, tickle, tickle, tickle. As long as you did, as long as you didn't really think that they were going to bite you, and they never did. And the same with the scorpions and other things which were there. And, you know, there's so much difficulty in that forest. It's okay, people say, oh, isn't it wonderful living close to nature? You go and sit out in the bush in Australia for half an hour, the ants get on you, the ticks get on you, the flies, there's so many things, they see you just as a source of dinner. If not dinner, then a sort of interest to go and crawl all over you. So sometimes people say, yeah, it's nice being in nature, but when you actually live out in nature, you realize it's actually nice being back home in the comforts of your rooms. But in those days, it wasn't just the physical hardness of the climate there. You know, for the locals, that's just how they lived. And I was mentioning that somebody asked me this question, was it really ascetic in Thailand? And how did those monks deal with that? And it's because these were the Thai monks in the northeast of Thailand. That's what they're used to. In fact, they used to like going from the village into the monastery because it was actually more comfortable for them than being in a village. But for Westerners, we were going from a place where there's nothing eating us, and you know, except our stupid mind and anger and guilt and all that sort of stuff, into a place with so many insects and a strange climate, and, you know, the food which we weren't used to at all. And talk about asceticism. Some of the things I put in my mouth when I was a young monk were just gross. You know, we did have like frog soup once. Now, I remember just as a kid, I used to watch Monty Python. For those of you who watch Monty Python, one of the sketches was Crunchy Frog, where somebody went into a movie theatre selling chocolate-covered Crunchy Frog. And they sort of ate this, and they said, this is gross, you left the bones in it. He said, that's why it's crunchy. And I thought, that's gross, that's why it's funny. And a few years later, I was eating Crunchy Frog, you know, without the chocolate. And this was all we had one day, a bowl of sticky rice and a pot, like a big saucepan, and you looked inside. There was no salt, nothing like garlic or anything. looks like boiled water, and floating it was about 20 like spoon-sized frogs. And that was our lunch. So only one meal a day. A bit of rice, and put the frog on your spoon, in your mouth, crunch. Boiled, crunchy frog. And there's other gross things, even more gross than that, was the time, it wasn't actually crunchy frog, it was like boiled frog, one each, a big one, like a toad, on rice. And there you was, your rice, and this toad on top of it. It wasn't toad in the hole. I used to like toad in the hole. That's an English dish, and it's sausages. This was a real toad. And the problem was, and this is true story, I was there. That's all we had that day. No fruit, no vegetables, no salt, no condiments, no chili or anything. Just one frog and a piece of rice, and that was it for the whole day. So you had to eat it. So, you know, I was fortunate. I would like to tell the story to kids, because some kids do not pay attention in school. You must pay attention in school, especially in biology. I did pay attention, and this is where I got the payback, because when you eat the meat off the legs of the frog, and I was a vegetarian before, okay, and I had to, there's no vegetables, it's rice and frog. So you take the meat off the legs first of all, you can actually eat that, that's not so bad, but that's not enough to keep you going for the day, so you have to start picking at its insides. I knew what organ was what. The guy sitting next to me did not. He pressed the bladder. It had urine in. And that frog peed all over his rice. It doesn't matter how hungry you are, you can't eat after that. Now that's what we mean by asceticism. And sometimes it's okay telling stories about that, but that was actually stupid. That was really ridiculous. That was a wrong way of practice. Because many of those monks got sick. As you'd imagine, you know, it's just no, it's not really a healthy diet. And because they got sick, many people actually left. And some of those were really good monks, just because not good enough food, they sort of lost the ability to actually to live and to meditate. And so many times you had diarrhea. You know, it's very good who lived in a forest, because it didn't really matter where you went. But you know, if you were in a village or in a sort of a town, it'd be terrible because it was getting, and this is bad for your health. And I remember one of our monks, and they were going to a big ceremony that morning, and our master Ajahn Chah was going to come and pick us up and go together, but he was late, so we went before him. Unfortunately, one of those monks, just before the master came, he had diarrhea, and he tried to get to the toilet and didn't make it. And there's this big pile of you-know-what in front of the toilet. And it always happens. People always get caught out because after he cleaned himself up, he didn't have time to clean up the path, then our master Ajahn Chah came and he had to use the toilet. And so he saw this big pile in front. And he told us off, he says, "You Western monks, you don't even know how to go to the toilet properly." It's very embarrassing. Always happens when you make a mistake. There's always the big boss or the big master finds out. But anyway, it was not healthy for you in places like that. And even some of the other ascetic things we try to do, to not to sleep much. One day a week, we'd actually stay up all night meditating. So 24 hours going without sleep. And again, that's not really sort of a good thing to do, but we thought that was being tough. And you know, this is what happens when you do things like that. I was actually very lucky. I must have had some good karma in the past, because I've been meditating all night. And just, you know, when you get to the early morning, you're very, very tired, and your mindfulness is not very strong. So remember, mindfulness is not very strong. And I went out of the hall the first light of day. It was dim. My mindfulness was weak, because I went to go to the toilet. Now, the Asian style, where you squat down. So imagine squatting down in the forest. You don't go to the toilets, it's jungle everywhere, you just go in the jungle. Squatting down and then urinating. And I thought I was urinating on a stick. It wasn't a stick. because it started to move. It was a snake. I was peeing on a snake. And I mention this to people because squatting down, the most sensitive part of a man's body was only a few inches from the mouth of a venomous snake. That was very dangerous. I do not recommend that to anybody. But fortunately, I had good karma. That snake never bit. You know why? Because I'm sure it thought it was being blessed by holy water. Holy water from a monk. But, I mean, that was the sort of asceticism which we were doing. But at that particular time, that was just going too far. And I often wondered, why do people do that? Why do they think they need to force their body and to force their mind to get any sort of peace, any wisdom, any sort of deep meditation, or anything really worthwhile in this life? Those people who actually carried on with that path, the ones who actually did succeed, most of them, they became these what we call the control freaks. They became these very strong-willed people who would get angry at other people because by controlling themselves, by forcing themselves to endure through some very, very harsh conditions, all they were really strengthening was their will. And when you strengthen your will that much and you survive, now you really think that through control you can force things through, you can push through things, you can get things done, you can achieve. And through will you can get other people to achieve, you can get other people to do what you want as well. It's through asceticism, and I've seen many monks who are very ascetic, I've seen them turn out to be great control freaks. And also, when they're control freaks, they get angry at other people, and they're very nasty people to be around. Because that type of asceticism is coming from negativity, from ill will, from anger. Thinking you're angry at your body, you're angry at life, that you just got to force the body through. And that's, I think, some of the reason why that asceticism, yeah, it can be very impressive sometimes. You see some people, and amazing just how you can endure that, I don't know. But it doesn't really work. It's a bit of a waste of time. And not only a waste of time, but it actually creates a lot of negativity in a person's mind. And that negativity will come out later in your life towards yourself with guilt because you can't always live up to your expectations. You can't always push through. You can't always just endure and think you're going to get somewhere. As I mentioned to many people, look, the path of Buddhism does not depend upon willpower. It depends upon wisdom power. Not willpower, but wisdom power. Because that willpower, if you keep pushing, you know what happens. And this is not just life as a monk. This is actually your lives. Keep pushing yourselves in your career. Keep forcing yourselves. And what really happens? You get frustrated, you get tense, you get angry, and you take that out on the people you love. Sometimes you take that out on your kids, you take that out on your body. You know, sometimes I was, what was it, in Singapore, I was visiting somebody in Singapore with cancer, and I went through what I thought was a cancer ward. It wasn't a cancer ward. It was a whole section of the hospital with people with cancer, ward after ward after ward after ward. And it really sort of struck me just how many people were getting this disease. And it seemed to be, I'm no sort of expert, it seemed to be that more people are getting this than ever before. And I thought, well, what is the situation? Is it just the chemicals in the atmosphere? I know that one sort of thing I can see which is happening these days, people work so hard and they force themselves so much. There's two more control freaks these days than there's ever been before. In olden days, we'd just take life more easy. We wouldn't sort of aspire to get such big houses, big salaries, big cars or whatever. We wouldn't have to work so hard. And because we weren't demanding so much of out of our lives, trying to squeeze more out of life, we had more time for ourselves, we were more relaxed, more easy to let things be. And I think that's one of the reasons why we were much healthier. That path of asceticism is not just eating frog on rice in a monastery. It's you just working too hard at work, being unkind to your body, forcing yourself, thinking, I'll just work a little bit harder, just keep on going for another few years, and then I can retire and I can let go. And I see many people say that, take the extra job. Just today there was I did a telephone interview for a magazine in Germany, in Frankfurt, because I'm going there next month. And they were just asking me, just what's the Buddhist idea of jealousy? And I said, jealousy is one of the most stupid of emotions. And sometimes people are jealous of people who get the promotion at work. You're dumb, you're stupid. If they get the promotion at work, wonderful. Just you go ahead and get more stress. Yeah, you get more money, but the amount of money you get when you have a promotion, it's still not enough. No matter how much you earn, it's never enough. But when you get the promotion, you still don't get enough money, but what you do get is more stress. So it's dumb. It's the other person, they want the promotion. Thank you, you take it, you take it. I'm going to have a stress-free life. And I don't get as much money, but I have more peace and more less responsibility and more sort of freedom in my life. Because the reason why we're jealous, we think they get the promotion, they're going to be happier. No, success doesn't generate happiness. Happiness generates success. So be happy first of all. Be happy where you are. This little job which I've got is great. I don't have as much worries as those other people. That's even my life as a monk. You know, I never wanted to be the senior monk or the teacher. There's no, Dennis knows, he's known me for such a long time. When I first came here, I had it all set up. There was another monk who was senior to me. We call it tailgating. You know, when you sort of you drive a bicycle behind a big truck and you get taken in a slipstream? Because the car in the front gets all the bugs on the windscreen. And so he was getting all the bugs, and I was nice having a tailgate. But then he left. And I was really disappointed about that, and he literally left me with a baby. So now I got all the bugs on my windscreen. That's what it's like being a leader. But anyone who wants to be a leader, you're absolutely crazy. What do you want to be a leader for? So don't be jealous. If someone gets a promotion, just give them sympathy. You poor thing, you've got the job. That's what I would do. So again, it's just, why do people have the wrong priorities in life? And sometimes people, they force themselves so much, they're being cruel to their body, they're being cruel to their life. It's being ascetic by working too hard. Okay, you say you've got to work hard to get your house. So what, you get your house, what happens when you get a long weekend? You go down south, you go up north, you go on a retreat with me or with one of the monks. What do you want a big house for? You never stay in it. Every time you get a weekend, you're away. Well, you have a nice house, and what do? You have to work on it. You know, just clean the gutters, clean out the storeroom, paint this and paint that. Gee, what are you doing this for? In my book, Open the Door of the Heart, I said, you should not be ascetic. Find a middle way. And I gave the simile of the garden. And I say, what have you got a garden in the back of your house for? What's its purpose? Is it just another place where you have to work? Another burden on your life? Or is it a place where you can just go out and relax? Your little area where no one can bother you. You just sit there and just do nothing. And years ago, I challenged one of the people who came here. You go in your garden. And you, 1 hour a week, middle way, just moderation, 1 hour a week, you sit there and do nothing. See if you can do that. And they found it so difficult to do. They said, they took out a radio and a magazine. So that's not doing nothing. That's reading. That's listening to music. Just sit there and do nothing. And then they came back and said, well, you know, I planned to sit down there, but, you know, I had to get the garden ready first of all. You know, there was a lot of watering, there's a lot of mowing to be done and cleaning up the leaves. And I thought, yeah, when I clean all that garden up, then I can actually have my hour. And of course, they never got to it. So I told them, look, you can't wait for perfection to take a break. You know, you have to sit in your garden as it is right now. So the next thing they did, they came back and they said, well, I tried that. You know, I tried, the garden was really imperfect, But when I sat there, I kept thinking, yeah, I mean, I really should be sort of raking up those leaves. Those plants really do need watering. And actually, we could actually put another plant in the corner over there and a nice little bird bath over here. There's planning again. That's not learning how to do nothing. You're being too ascetic with your brain. Always working it like some slave driver, never letting sort of the slave be still, even for one moment. Now you imagine somebody like that, this sadistic guard with a whip and always beating you. As soon as you sit down for a moment and do nothing, say, no, go and do this, you've got to do this, you've got to do that, come on, don't be lazy. You know that when I grew up in Christianity, they had this phrase, the devil makes work for idle hands. I've had idle hands for hours, for days, for months on end meditating. And I tell you, the devil does not make work for idle hands. But just you have lots of bliss when you stop doing things. We do too much. So to test yourself, just go out there into the garden. Sit down and learn how to do nothing. Rest at least some time in a day. And then people say, well, if you just do that all the time, that we get nothing done. Of course, this is a middle way. Give yourself just an hour of the week. That's not that long, is it? And what you find is it's so hard to do. Why is that? And it's because that we're just too ascetic, too trying, we're going everywhere. We don't know how to relax and rest. And it was when the Buddha sort of found this middle way. He said, let's look, you've got to be kind to yourself. Asceticism is actually full of ill will, negativity, beating yourself, starving yourself, and people think that that's discipline. You don't get discipline that way. One of my favorite stories is from the Chinese Art of War, where one of the emperor's generals had perfect discipline in his regiment, much better discipline than any other regiment. And so the emperor asked him, what's your secret? How come your soldiers always follow orders? Well, in other regiments, sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. And the general replied, you know, Your Majesty, my soldiers always follow my orders because I only ever tell them what they want to do. That's why they follow my orders. Imagine that at work. Your boss only telling you what you want to do. And of course you'll follow orders. But it was obviously there was more to it than that, because these soldiers would get up early in the morning to train. They just worked really hard, you know, training in their skills. And when it came time for a battle, they were willing to just go into battle and even risk injury or death. How on earth can you get someone to want to do that? And it's obvious, the motivation. That general was a hugely effective motivator. When he was training those troops, he sort of almost brainwashed them to want to get up in the morning. So when that bell or that gong went, they couldn't wait to get up. When it came to training, yeah, let us up the training. When it came to going to battle, they couldn't wait to go in there and fight. That's why they followed orders. Now to me, that was the key of discipline. Even in my own life as a monk, and certainly the way that I discipline the monks at my monastery, you don't go around shouting at people. You motivate them to want to do these things. Now this is the middle way. So for whatever you want to do, don't beat yourself up, don't shout at people. Through kindness, through wisdom, power, motivate. Now especially yourself in your spiritual life. Motivate yourself. What do you really want to do in life? Use wisdom power. I already mentioned one of the great secrets of success is happiness comes first. This is psychological studies done in many countries in the world. If you want to find out sort of the full details, go on the internet. But basically, it was actually showing that successful people aren't happy, but happy people are successful. Happiness has to come first. And it's obvious, because if you're not happy, if you're ascetic and you have to push things through, you will fail. You haven't got the energy, the motivation, sort of the get up and go, because you want to get up and go. If you really don't want to get up on a Monday morning, I don't want to get up on a Monday morning, go to work again, of course you're going to fail. So you motivate yourself. I motivate myself every morning, as I keep saying here. Every morning when I wake up, good morning me, here I am again, zippity-doo-da, what a great day. Yeah, meditation, woo, yeah. I actually do that. And I motivate myself, so I love getting up early in the morning. It's great. I'm living in a monastery, a beautiful place. What a great thing this life is. I motivate myself, so I really put energy into it. Another Friday night, yeah, I can really give a nice Dhamma talk to people, enjoy the fellowship with all you guys. So when you motivate yourself like that, there's no discipline left at all. You don't have to tell yourself to do things. There's no asceticism left anymore. It's run on joy, motivation and joy. And you can see just how much energy you get from joy. Asceticism is a negative energy. It feels painful, but you push your way through it, it's hard, and it hasn't got any softness, it's got no compassion to it. One of the great sort of symbols of Buddhism is compassion. The Buddha was always kind and compassionate. Look, if you look at some of the stories in Buddhism, people came to assassinate the Buddha. And what did he do? He said, oh, never mind, I'll forgive you, I'll let it go. And he never called the cops, he never had them arrested, he just made them monks. It's amazing just what the Buddha was doing. Now this is actually that kindness and that gentleness, you know, which is beautiful. Like one of those stories about sort of asceticism, and this is actually a story I haven't told for years. It's one of the key stories in that book, Opening the Door of Your Heart, but I haven't told it for a long time now, and actually it's going to involve some of you. I hope you don't remember this story, some of you, but it's a story, it's a powerful story, the story of the seven monks in the cave. If you haven't heard this story, listen carefully, because I am going to ask you a question to see if you can understand this. And from this little story, it's going to elicit a lack of wisdom in many people. And because they don't see this point clearly, it causes them a lot of pain in their life. So listen carefully. Seven monks were meditating in a cave a long time ago. Now the seven monks were this. There was the senior monk, the head monk. The number two was his brother. The third monk was his best friend. They'd all become monks together. The fourth monk was like an enemy. Even though they were monks together, they had a personality clash. And sometimes you do, they just couldn't get on. Maybe some karma from the past, but the fourth monk was the enemy. The fifth monk was a very old monk. So advanced in years that, you know, he could die any time. You know, just out of old age. You know, you've seen monks like that, you've seen people like that. They're so old, they're going around and wobbling around and had in and out of hospital, any time they can die. They've lived their life. So the fifth monk was a very old monk. Number six was a very ill monk. He was always, you know, sort of sickly with this and sickly with that. And he was, you know, in one of these sicknesses, and they thought he could die any time as well. And they were just wondering who would die first, the old monk and the sick monk. And the last monk, number seven, was a stupid monk. And I always say, every monastery has to have one. But not this monk, this is a very good monk. And this stupid monk, he couldn't keep his robes on properly. Maybe it's me. Every time he started chanting, he always forgot the chants. And he couldn't. Every time he meditated, he fell asleep and snored. He was just one of these monks, he couldn't do anything right. He was absolutely stupid. But out of compassion, they let that monk stay with them. So that was the seventh monk, the stupid monk. Now they were meditating in this cave in the jungle, and this band of robbers, they found that cave in the jungle, and they wanted to take it over for themselves, because it was a great hideout for them. It's a place where they could actually, when they stole from the villages and the cities and the towns, they could take all their loot back and hide it in the cave, and they could also make sure they weren't caught by, you know, the authorities. It was a great hideout for them. But of course, They had to get the monks out first of all. And they didn't want any of those monks to sort of tell the authorities where they were staying, so they decided to kill all those monks, to slaughter them. And this is actually based on a true story. I've changed many of the details, actually 99% of those details, but it's based on a true story. So if you want to see it, Taraputa Thera. But the head monk, now he could talk the hind legs off a donkey, as they say. He was just had the gift of the gab. So he talked to the head of the robbers, and he managed to convince the head of the robbers, don't ask me why, how rather, to let all the monks go. But the robbers insisted on killing one of the monks as a warning to the rest to keep quiet. Because this is what will happen to you. We'll catch you, we'll kill you, you know, if you tell the authorities where we are. It shows we're serious. So they insisted on killing one of the monks, and that's the best the head monk can do. So the head monk had to make this decision, who would die so all the rest could live. And I'm going to ask you in a few moments who that head monk chose. But I'll tell you first of all those seven monks, so you can make your decision. Imagine you were that head monk. Now those seven monks were this. The head monk, the brother, the best friend, the enemy, who he never really liked. It'd be nice if he got rid of him. The old monk, who's going to die at any time, lived his life. The sick monk, who also was just so sick, it would be almost like putting him out of his misery, it'd be like euthanasia. And the last monk, the stupid monk, who'd never done anything right, never done any good karma throughout his whole life. The stupid monk. Now, if you've read that story and remember it, or if you've heard it before, I'd ask you to be quiet here. Those who haven't heard it before, who do you think? Who do you think that head monk chose? Any suggestions? Himself? Please put your hands up if you think he sacrificed himself. Be honest. Be to your courage of your convictions. Okay, you are all wrong. I always do that. I love doing that. No, you're wrong. That's the wrong answer. But the reason why people usually, if they haven't heard that story ever before, they always usually say sacrifice themselves, because that's a sign of asceticism. Sacrificing yourself for others all the time. Always just putting yourself last. In our Western culture, we think that's wise. That's one of the reasons why people have low self-esteem. It's a sign of low self-esteem. Why they sort of never have much happiness in their life or any progress, always putting yourself last. That was a wrong answer. Any other suggestions? Yeah?
Couldn't that be like a true inner altruism?
Inner altruism. He sacrificed himself as altruistic. Nah, sometimes we think it's altruism, but that's compassion without wisdom. I'll tell you the answer, because the answer is actually, when I first saw this, wow, brilliant. The answer was, he could not choose. His love towards his best friend was exactly the same as it was towards his brother. No more, no less. And he loved the enemy, exactly the same as his brother, no more, no less. As he loved the old monk, the sick monk, even the stupid monk, he loved everybody equally, evenly, with no distinction. And most importantly, he loved himself no more, no less than every other monk. His love was even, and he never looked at himself any more or any less than any other monk. When I tell this to non-Buddhist audiences, I invoke one of the sayings in the Bible. To love your neighbor as yourself means not to love your neighbor more than yourself, not less than yourself, as yourself. To love your neighbor as yourself means to love yourself as your neighbor. No more, no less. sacrificing yourself implies that you value yourself less than your neighbor. Now that's where asceticism comes from. That's where sacrifice comes from. There is another way. When that monk told the head of the robbers that he couldn't make a choice, and why, that his love for every one of those monks was exactly the same, no more, no less, than his love for himself, the head of the robbers was so impressed that not only did he let the monks go free, half of those robbers became monks and the other half went back to their village. That part of the story was true according to the Theragata Thalaputta's Thera. Now that is an amazing story. It is because sometimes, especially in our culture, we think it's a good thing to sacrifice ourselves for other people. It doesn't work that way. We count too. No more than your friend, but certainly no less. When we understand that type of love, we understand what the middle way is. You count. No more, no less. So why is it you tell other people, come and take a break, take a rest, don't work so hard. And look at yourself, what you're doing. Do you treat yourself as you would treat other people? If you would you be so cruel and so unkind and so fierce with others? Usually would say no, so please treat yourself as you would treat others. Be kind to yourself, be caring to yourself, and that takes away all of the asceticism. So as a Buddhist monk, I was taught how to love myself. Sometimes people think, if you love yourself, you're going to get this big head. You're going to be just so proud and arrogant, you're going to be insufferable. That's not how it works. That's one of those other myths. If you love yourself, you don't get a big head. You get a big heart when you love yourself. You love yourself, you learn how to love other people. Hate yourself, asceticism, and then you start hating others. Control yourself and you start controlling others. And then you try and control life. Going back to that cancer thing, there is a link which I see. I mean, I'm no psychologist, but I've been meditating for such a long time. I understand how these minds work. From controlling, you get frustrated. Because sometimes you just can't do it. Sometimes you can't sort of stop the mind wandering or thinking. Come on, get your act together. Sometimes you just can't stop making mistakes. Come on, me, get your act together. You get frustrated after a while. And sometimes people, like, from frustrating, they just try and control harder. Come on, push through this. And then you get to the next stage we call anger. Control, frustration, anger. And you've seen that happening in your family. You're trying to sort of control the situation in the family, but people get so stupid. Why can't they see what to do? Why can't they understand how hard I work for them? Frustration leads to anger, and you say all these terrible things about other people and also to yourself. And anger sucks up so much energy, so much emotional power. If you get angry long enough, you've got nothing left. You get depressed. Depressed means no spiritual energy left. You fought, failed, and you basically got nothing left. I've seen that too many times. That lack of spiritual energy, that mind energy, is also causes problems to the body, sicknesses such as cancer. Simply because two people are just trying too hard, they're just control freaks, and they don't love themselves. If you really loved your kid, and your kid didn't do well at school, you say, oh, come on, you're still my kid. You know, that even if you didn't sort of pass the exams at school, it doesn't matter. I can always find you a place in Ajahn Brahm's monastery as a monk. As I stay, we always have one stupid monk in a monastery. Or a stupid nun at Dhammasara. We can always go over there. We can always find a place for you. But look, if that's your kid, Yeah, you want them to do well, but it doesn't matter. You can still find them a job somewhere. You give them a hug, you're kind to them, because you love them. Loving a person means you accept them. You want to do well, but nevertheless, you're just kind to them. You're soft to them. Just, you know, just talking today in an interview about my own father. My own father was so kind to me. He wanted me to do well. But he said, it doesn't matter if you don't do well. You're still my son. You know, you always have a place. You always have food on the table. And that degree of acceptance of me, that taught me what love was. That was an ascetic type of love. Now, one of the reasons for that, why my father sort of was like that, was because he had a violent father who kept on beating him with a belt. And I remember him telling me, he said, why don't you do that to me, Dad? And he said, look, I was on the end of that belt so many times. He said, I made a resolution when I was being whipped. If ever I have a child, I'll never do that to him. And you're that child. That's why I'll never do that to you. Wow, that's a powerful father. He taught me love in a very deep way. He didn't need to discipline me. He motivated me to want to do the right thing by him. And that was much more powerful than any belting. Motivation, love, kindness. And that's why I learned how to love myself and be kind to myself. I don't need to. If I'm a silly monk and make a mistake, I don't get out a belt and whip myself. That's a stupid thing to do. Just forgive. Try and do better next time. Learn, motivate myself through kindness, through love. Now that was a beautiful middle path of the Buddha, which I recognized when I first picked up my book on Buddhism. In monasteries, now this is, I don't know when I told this story, in monasteries we don't have punishments. I don't know when the last time I told a story about the Anagarika. This is the postulate in our monastery. He was in white, training to be a monk. And he came up to me. He's like a Westerner. He didn't really know too much about Buddhism. But he wanted to train himself. And so he came up and said, look, I'm terribly sorry. I have to confess I made a mistake. I said, what did you do? And he said, well, yesterday I was hungry. I went into the kitchen and made myself a sandwich. In the afternoon, that's breaking your precepts. Even like people keeping 8 precepts. See some of these girls in white, they're keeping 8 precepts for the weekend, which means they don't eat anything in the afternoon or the evening or at night time. And this was one of my trainees. He went into the kitchen and got a sandwich. And he said, I never slept last night very well. I felt so guilty. So I told him, I said, okay, well done, you've confessed it. That's really important. You don't hide it, you don't deny it, bring it up. And say, now you've confessed it, the next thing to do is try and get some strategies so you don't feel so hungry. Eat more at lunchtime. And if you do need something to eat in the afternoon, it's not ascetic monastery. You can go and have, you know, some orange juice, make yourself a cup of tea, put heaps of honey in it or something. Give yourself something which is allowable so you don't feel hungry. Okay? He said, that's a good idea, so you can go now. He said, no. So why can't, what's wrong? He said, look, I need to be punished. He said, because that's my character. If I don't get punished, I'll do it again. That's who I am. you know such people. You may be one of those types of people. So he said, you want to be punished? He said, yes. And as it happened, that very day I was reading a book by Robert Hughes, one of the great Australian authors, called The Fatal Shore. I always remember that book. And it was a history of the early days of Australia. And I just had been reading that morning about one of the characters who got flogged with a cat of nine tails. And it was fresh in my mind. So I said, you want a punishment? I'll give you a traditional Australian punishment. 50 strokes of the cat. And this guy, his face went whiter than the clothes he was wearing. He thought, oh my God, Ajahn Brahm's going to whip me. Because he didn't really know me all that well. You know, those of you who know me just would laugh at that. There must be something, you know, up here that can't be true. But he thought I was really going to whip him. Well, you asked for a punishment. And then I told him what 50 strokes of the cat mean in a Buddhist monastery. We have 2 cats. Find one of them and stroke it. 1. There, cat 2. 3, 4, until that cat starts purring. Then learn some kindness and compassion and love, you hard-hearted, you know, postulant. Because that's what it was. He was just so negative and hard and ascetic. And that's why I gave him 50 strokes of the cat, to learn some kindness and compassion. So that's one of my favorite punishments in a monastery. You know, you might, if, you know, if you're, you do something wrong at home, find a cat, a dog will do, 50 strokes of the dog, anything. Just stroke. Because why is it that people don't have kindness? And it's those people who don't have kindness, they're the ascetic ones. They do whip themselves, they do fast, you know, and just to, because they think it's going to sort of somehow, you know, no pain, no gain. That's not how we have it in Buddhism. In Buddhism, it's no joy, no gain. So instead of actually just hurting yourself, we have this beautiful path of love which gives so much happiness and joy in your heart. And that's the motivation. Even now, that all of you, most of you were meditating here before you, I started talking here. How do you meditate? Are you ascetic in the way you meditate, forcing your mind, telling your mind what you have to do, and beating yourself every time you fall asleep or you wander off and waste time? Are you ascetic inside? When you sort of make mistakes, do you want to be punished? A lot of times people are like that, and that's the ascetic part of you, and it's a controller, it's a hate. It lacks a sort of kindness and love, which is what Buddhism is supposed to be doing. For many people, when they're meditating, I say, imagine you're a Buddha meditating. A Buddha doesn't go around being cruel and unkind like that. Be kind, be gentle. Have some compassion to your poor brain and your body. Be kind. And that compassion and a kindness is a middle way. Not indulging. A lot of indulging the body, just watching the movies, stuffing stuff in your mouth, you know, when you don't really need it, you're not really hungry, you're just doing that. A lot of that is escaping from things. Why are you escaping? Because you don't want to be here. You know, you want sort of something to distract yourself. Why don't you be here? Because you've got no love in your heart. You don't like yourself. Which means you're always trying to run away in some sort of sensory indulgence or whatever. So when you like yourself, you can sit in your garden in the back of your house. It doesn't have to be perfect to be a peaceful place. That's one of the great insights which you will get. You don't have to have a garden where everything in its right place to have peace. You learn to appreciate the garden even though the trees are wobbling all over the place, even though that some of the flowers are dying, even if the grass needs mowing and there's leaves all over the place looks a mess. Beautiful. Just like me. I'm a mess. The garden's a mess. I love you, garden. I love me. You don't have to be perfect, first of all. That's one of the great insights. It's such a relief to know you don't have to be perfect to be at peace. Such a relief to know other people don't have to be perfect to be your friends. So when there's no demand for perfection, all this controlling, all this demanding things to be different, all vanishes away and you can find some peace, some kindness to love. My father didn't want me to be perfect. If I could be better, he'd be happy, but I was good enough for him. Even in the imperfection of being a young man, he could give me unconditional love. That was middle way. It was full of joy, full of happiness. So you don't have to have a perfect mind to have a joyful meditation. Say thank you, mind, just for being here. This is good enough, as I kept on saying. You can be content with a garden which is a mess. So you can be content with your mind, which is a mess. To love yourself as you love all other things. To love the crazy mind as well as a peaceful mind. Just like that monk loved all of the monks evenly without any exception. To love all the states of your mind. That's the middle way. That gives you joy. So it means you're not fighting, you're not controlling, you're accepting, you're letting things be, you're being at peace with things. Now when you start that, now that really is a powerful spiritual path. It's a path which does get you into harmony with other people and with yourself and with your mind. Without harmony inside, where can there ever be any peace, any deep meditation, any great insight? So basically this is what we do when we sit down. We learn how to live in harmony with our mind, not by trying to control it and make it different, but loving it for what it is. It doesn't have to be perfect. We're not hating it. We're not being ascetic and trying to change our mind and forcing it. We're using this great wisdom power, which can leave it alone and let it be. And then a great thing happens. This is peace. All the time you try and find peace, insight, wisdom, truth, through fighting, you find all those wars just create casualties. I'm not talking about the wars on the battlefields of the countries. I'm talking about the battlefield between your ears, the battlefield of your mind, fighting, trying to change things, trying to sort of get your act together. All that fighting, all that war, all those battles which have gone on for such a long time. When will those battles be finished? These are battles you will never win until you learn how just to let things be. Do you learn how to accept the black and the white, the dark and the bright, and harmonize them together just by letting them be? And then you find that when you make peace with things, just the mind gets filled with peace. And you find, I never really needed to fight. What I needed to do was to sit down and rest. Enlightenment comes to you. You never go fighting and searching for enlightenment. It's the wisdom of letting go. Which is why when the Buddha felt, for 6 years, according to the story, he was fighting his body, fighting his mind, and got just so frustrated until he just gave in. What a beautiful thing that is, to give in, to let go, to stop fighting, and to follow a path of love and kindness. He was kind to his body. He never sort of ate frog on rice like I did. Before he got enlightened, he had this meal which was prepared as an offering for spirits. It was holy food, deva food, the very best food you could possibly get. That's what he ate before he became enlightened. So if you want to become enlightened, go to a 5-star restaurant first of all, pick out, no, that's not, maybe not the right way of saying it, but have a good meal first of all. He had a good bath. And he, for those of you who have ever gone to sort of Bodh Gaya in India, the place where the Buddha became enlightened, it was on this beautiful river, this beautiful grove. It was like King's Park, only flat. It was a beautiful place. In that sort of state of ease, kindness to your body, only then can you have peace of the body. You force the body, and you always have tension. You're kind to the body. Give it rest when it needs rest. Scratch it when it needs scratching. I always joke, that's why in this tradition we always close our eyes when we meditate. You know why we close our eyes in this tradition when we meditate? So you can pick your nose, put your finger in your ear, no one's watching because everyone's got their eyes closed. It's compassion! But by being kind to your body, it relaxes. So being kind to your body, the next thing, you're kind to the mind, and the mind relaxes. If you're ascetic and try and force it, it never works. I know some of these meditation traditions, they sit there and force their way through and sit through pain. I remember one of my friends, a monk, he's over in England, he decided, right, this is it, I'm going to sit through pain. It doesn't matter just how much it hurts, I'm just going to sit through this. I'm tough, I'm going to get enlightened, this is enlightenment or bust. He had to have double knee reconstruction. And I remember, this is no joke, it was true. He bust his knees up and they're still not all that good. And I'm saying, what do you do that for? That asceticism is just, it's willpower and it's stupid. So don't have willpower, have wisdom power, have joy power, have love power. It's far more effective, especially in your spiritual path. Be kind to yourself. Be kind to your mind. And I was just telling someone earlier, they just went on the last weekend retreat and their mind was wandering all weekend. So what should I do? It's because you were fighting the mind, you're trying to control it. whereas you should be kind to your mind. And I told her this story, this last story I'm going to tell this evening. It's a personal story. And it was, this taught me how to meditate and how not to meditate, what the middle path was. 30 years ago this happened. I was 6 years as a monk in a very secluded monastery. Just quiet, peaceful, perfect. But then my meditation started to sort of nosedive. I couldn't stop my mind from thinking. It was really restless, but big time restless. And the thoughts which started coming into my mind were what I called unmonkish thoughts. Thoughts about old girlfriends, romance, sex, anything. All these thoughts started, and I was a monk. I'm trying to be a good monk. And I really tried to stop these thoughts coming into my mind. I did battle with them. But it was just so difficult. I had a lot of willpower. I tried to watch my breath, but after a while these thoughts were like to batter down the doors and just come in. And it was just hopeless. And it gets, you know, so frustrating for those of you who've been there and done that, trying to control the mind, especially when it gets really wrong, silly, stupid, or in that case, very, very bad thoughts. And I got desperate. And because I was staying alone, I had no one to talk to, no one to get some good advice to. So out of desperation, I went into the main hall of this monastery, bowed to the Buddha statue, and I sort of, you know, asked for some help. And what I sort of got was, make a deal. Make a deal. And the deal was, for 1 hour every afternoon, I'd allow my mind to do whatever it wanted to. Could think any thought it wanted to. The rest of the day, I'd watch my breath and be a good monk. If you want to play around, 3 to 4 p.m. every afternoon, you could go for broke. I thought that was fair enough. I thought that would make sense. But it never worked as I expected it to. My mind was still as uncontrollable. I was fighting. But then, when it came to 3 o'clock, I went up to my room, rested, and I said to my mind, whatever you want to do for the next hour, anything goes. And for that hour, I watched every breath without missing one. It was so easy to do. And I realized why my mind was wandering. Because I was trying to control it. The controlling it was hating it. When it was hating it, the mind never wanted to cooperate. That was asceticism. And that was why you get all these really crazy thoughts. I think even some of that paedophilia in, say, the Catholic Church or other places, sometimes it causes too much asceticism. They don't love their mind. Therefore you get all these stupid thoughts coming up. This is just maybe, I'm not sure. But I think it's maybe one cause. But when you love your mind, you say, okay, mind, if that's what you want to do, fine, go for it. Because I loved my mind and gave it some peace and respect, my mind cooperated totally and watched every breath without any problem whatsoever. And it was so joyful. That was the middle way. A way of peace, a way of love, a way of kindness, a way of softness. That is a path to deep meditation. It's a path to peace, the path to enlightenment. Force and will, that just makes a stronger ego, a stronger self. Control does create arrogance. Love creates peace. That's the path, the middle way. Hope you understood some of it, because it will affect your spiritual path immensely. And thank you for listening.